You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Now we're going to talk about everybody's favorite, or maybe least favorite, subject, themselves. Specifically, is the person you are now the same person you were a year ago, pre-pandemic, 10 years ago as a child? Or do you feel like now you're somebody different? Turns out that a lot of people feel one way, a lot the opposite, and that can have an influence on how we grow and develop as people. We're listening back to a conversation about that now, and you can let us know what you think by emailing ideas@wpr.org. Do you have observations you could share of your own personality and whether it's changed over time? How about kids, spouses, friends, and whether they think they've changed over time? Do you think a lot about whether or not you've changed as a person, or do you just roll with whoever you are today? Let us know. Email ideas@wpr.org. Joshua Rothman is ideas editor and writer for The New Yorker. He wrote a piece about our changing identities titled, Are You the Same Person You Used to Be? I talked with him last month. Here's a listen. I want to go down the road of what led you into this. And if I'm reading you right, it started with you looking at your own kid and thinking back on your own childhood. How did that take you into this exploration of identity?
Yeah. So I have a son. He's 4.5 and he has a big personality. And, you know, it's natural to wonder, is that going to be his personality forever? What's the future going to hold? And I was around the dinner table with, you know, my son, my wife, my in-laws, and we got to talking. And one thing that really struck me was people have really, really different views about whether they've changed a lot or whether they've always been the same person their whole lives. Like, they hold very, very strong opinions about this and really divergent opinions. Some people feel very strongly that the person they are at age, let's say 45, is the same person they were when they were 5. Other people feel that they've changed once, twice, maybe many times, that they've had lots of turning points, and that, you know, maybe they're almost like unrecognizable, the person that they are now versus who they once were. I just thought that was so fascinating, and I wanted to write about it.
Yeah, what is it, or what do we know about what makes one person I think you used the words, a continuer or a divider as they look back on their life story?
Well, you know, one thing that has struck me in talking, to write this article, I talked to a lot of people, and I just asked them the question we're talking about. And, you know, people have really different views, but the views they have, you know, they're part of a story that has to do with the kind of person they want to be, the values they want to have. Some people are sort of loyal to themselves, if you know what I mean. They value their own consistency through time. They see that as a virtue. Other people who are dividers, they feel they've changed a lot. Like, they value the fact that they're growing and changing, that they're open to new things. Or maybe there are really important experiences that they feel are part of them, and that serve as dividing lines in their lives. Or maybe they want to change now. Maybe they want to be dynamic now. And so when they look back on their lives, they emphasize how they've changed. I think, you know, part of it is just our own intuitions, our own personalities. And part of it is that, you know, what we think about what's led us to the present has bearing on what we think will happen to us in the future and the type of person that we plan to be in the future.
Talking to Joshua Rothman with New Yorker about a piece he wrote on how we think of our identities. Are we the same person from our childhood through our adult years? Is it a continuous story? Or are we different people at different stages? You ask different people, you get a different answer to that question. You can share your answer, your experience, your thoughts on this at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Max is with us in Green Bay. Max, hi.
Hi. I called because, you know, I heard you say, you know, how have you changed in the past year or pre-pandemic or 10 years? And I can honestly say in the past 4 months, I have changed a lot. We welcomed our baby girl into the world on November 5th, and boy, has my life changed. For the better, I'd like to add, but I just, the things that, you know, suddenly you care about if a onesie has two zippers on it, or when you hear that first giggle or see that first smile, you just melt. Or I was lucky enough to stay at home with my daughter for the first 3 months, just watching her grow and develop every day. And then the longing I experience of, you know, driving truck for 12 hours a day and not being able to see her. It's just something I never thought I'd experience myself, but here we are.
I absolutely hear you, Max. Same thing, you know, when I first had kids a little longer ago, I got to say. But do you feel like, okay, Max the dad is a different dude than Max the pre-dad? Or is it like you're a dad now, but you were set up by your experiences coming in? It's a weird, subtle question. Does it make sense to you?
Yes, it does. I feel as if I'm maybe not a whole different person, but I am definitely Max the dad now. Sometimes it's kind of hard to relate to a couple of my friends who aren't parents, because like you just find yourself going on and on about like what my daughter did today or how she's developing. But I don't feel like I'm a completely different person, I guess. I hope that was the proper response, and I'm not just going on and on.
Oh, that's fine. There isn't a right answer, I think, is the answer. Joshua, that the idea that we have different chapters in our lives, one really easy chapter is being a parent all of a sudden. Do you see people looking at that as a common dividing point in their different identities in their lives?
Yeah, parenthood is definitely a big one, a big chapter divider. Or you know, to use a TV metaphor, it's like season one, season two, season three. You know, like season three might be you become a parent. But there are lots of other dividing lines that that some people feel really separate their lives into sections. You know, moving to a new country, becoming an immigrant, that's a really big one. Doing things like going to war, having, you know, traumatic, challenging, kind of transformative experiences, that's a big one. I talked to one person who was a doctor. She'd worked in sort of a fancy hospital for a long period of time, and then she worked in a hospital that was in an economically, you know, deprived area where the patients were totally different, the challenges were totally different. She felt like that was too sort of portions of her life. And so there's lots of different, you know, events that can be boundaries. And, you know, one question which has come up in this conversation is, you know, can your life change and you remain the same, but your life has chapters, but you're still the same dude, the same personality, the same things, you know, the same disposition reacting to all these changes? Or have these changes changed you in some deeper way, where, you know, when you look in the mirror, there's a different person looking back? People have different feelings about that.
Max, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Joshua, before we go back to our callers, you know, a lot of this feels kind of philosophical and personal, but some psychologists have tried to study this, and you look closely at this study, a big study in New Zealand. Can you tell us about this?
It's a fascinating study. So, you know, it's what's called a prospective study, which is to say, it's not talking to people who are grown and asking them, what were you like as a kid? Have you changed? It's following people from when they were born over decades and trying to see if they've remained consistent or if they've changed in different ways. And basically what the researchers find after following people for, you know, well, I think it's more than four decades through their lives, is that some types of character traits are more persistent than others. So some of us don't change in very specific ways because of who we are. And essentially what they find is, you know, if you imagine a big group of, you know, 100 kids, 100 elementary school kids, they're all different. They all have different traits. You know, some are really courageous, some are really social, some are really funny, some are really, you know, whatever. But there's two traits that are persistent through time. One is being what they call inhibited, but I think it really just means keeping to yourself, you know, being self-contained. People who are self-contained when they're small continue to be self-contained into adulthood. And the other is being sort of adversarial. They call it moving against the world, being a person who is prone to conflict. And both of those things persist in part because if you're a person who keeps to yourself, you kind of create a social niche for yourself where, you know, not that much is going to come in and change that. If you're sort of a person who has struggled to get along with other people, that's persistent because it's sort of self-reinforcing, you know? And those are two traits that, you know, statistically, so not, it's not determinative, but statistically they tend to sort of persist, you know, but things can change them. Having a marriage, a romantic partner, a mentor, having a close relationship with someone can change the dynamics there and sort of cause a reset in some ways. So, you know, it's a fascinating study that shows that, you know, although to some extent all of our personality traits, you know, are consistent through our lives, there are some traits that kind of have more sticking power than others. And it can kind of isolate them by looking at all those people through time.
We're talking to Joshua Rothman, ideas editor at The New Yorker, about whether who we are as individuals stays the same over time or if it can and actually does change through the years. You can join in with your thoughts on that question at 800-642-1234. When you look back in your life, do you see it as one consistent story where you're basically the same person through it, or is it really separate chapters where you're a different person at different stages? No wrong answer to that question. A lot of people answer one way or the other. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Joshua Rothman, ideas editor and writer at The New Yorker, talking about a piece he wrote called "Are You the Same Person You Used to Be?" Looking at questions of identity, personality, if we're the same person all along or different people at different stages of our lives, if we can change ourselves significantly on purpose. You can join in with your answers at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I love talking about this. I had like a philosophical awakening in college. Soren Kierkegaard was my favorite philosopher, and I had this self-awareness that as I grew up, every decade I had a new opportunity, new challenges. And I got to tell you, I thought I was Brad Pitt in my 20s and Tom Cruise in my 30s, and then Tom Hanks, and then probably Jerry Seinfeld, and now I think I'm Charlton Heston. Do you think the media influences who we are because of the time we live in?
Oh, interesting. Jeff, thanks a lot for that. You know, so pop culture definitely offers us a lot of models to define our identity and define our life stories. Do you see that, Joshua?
I love that. I love that list of actors. They sound like pretty good. I bet you're not the only one who has that, those desires to be those guys. It's a great question. You know, how much does the world we grew up in sort of determine who we are? You know, talk to some people, for example, who, you know, they were in their 20s in the 1960s. And during that time, they were politically incredibly liberal. They were hippies. They had a whole way of life that was related to the 60s. They were swept up in a culture at that time. And then a couple decades later, they find, you know, their politics have changed, their whole lifestyle has changed. And when you look at photos of a couple decades before, it's like you can't even recognize that person. You know, like my dad, he if you look at photos of him in the 70s, he has crazy hair and he's into all sorts of crazy jazz. And he's like this really far out guy. I have siblings who are a lot younger than me. And, you know, I remember that version of my dad that existed when he was, you know, a far out guy. And they only know the older version of my dad, who's the most straight laced person ever. And that question of, you know, have you changed because the times have changed, is a great question. And one thing it speaks to is how in certain ways we're really malleable, and the things we're interested in are sort of they're part of the times. Now, is there a core of you that stayed the same, you know, that was interested in Kierkegaard when you were young and, you know, still now is? There very well might be. So one question you can, you know, that I think a lot of people find themselves thinking about when they explore this is, what parts of me are changeable and what parts of me are durable? And you know, maybe you have a heterogeneous kind of identity, with certain things being, you know, very dynamic and other things being, you know, very, very consistent through time.
Thanks for that call, Jeff. Tony joins us now in Sturgeon Bay. Tony, hi.
Hi, guys. I'm under the column of I'm the same person I've always been, which was very impetuous and very inquisitive. A 67-year-old guy who read a book called Your Table is Ready about a New York maitre d'. And I just became a waiter for the first time in my life at a fine Italian restaurant in Sturgeon Bay. And I know nothing about waiting tables. I've been doing it a month, and it's the most terrifying thing I've ever done. But I've always challenged myself And in the beginning, it's always pure terror until I figure it out. So I like who I am. And as Popeye said, I am what I am.
Tony, great Popeye quote to sum up that continuer thing. Tony, impetuous and inquisitive all his life, and he's sticking with it, Joshua. He's definitely on that continuer side of the equation.
You know, I think a lot of people, some people have the the experience of knowing they're continuers. But sometimes it's a thing people discover, which is kind of interesting. Like, you thought you were changing, you know, you thought things were really up in the air. And then when you reach a certain point in your life, you sort of decide who that you accept who you've always been. That's a formulation that comes up. One guy I talked to for this piece, he described having a life that he thought was very changeable, but then one day discovering like an old journal in which he'd written a bunch of short stories. And at that time that he was older, he, you know, retired and he was trying his hand at writing fiction. And then he went back and looked at these old stories and saw they were exactly the same. So, you know, the reality, as it were, of being a continuer is something people sometimes just discover.
Thanks a lot for that call, Tony. If I swing by Sturgeon Bay, I'll try to track down your restaurant. I'm a pretty mellow customer, so don't worry. We are talking about who we are, our identity, how it changes, if it changes over time, with Joshua Rothman at The New Yorker. Back to your calls now. Ben is on the line in Watertown. Ben, hi.
Yeah, hello. Can you hear me okay?
Loud and clear. What did you want to bring up?
Yeah, well, I'm a fan of this British documentary, 7-Up, and the 7-Up series. I don't know if the expert you have there is familiar with it, but pretty much these young people at 7 years old, you're 1956, I think, 58, had an idea of what they wanted to be, whether it be a lower-class young man wanted to be a jockey, an upper-class boy going to a private school, already knew he wanted to be a barrister. One of the other young women said, I'm going to be working at Woolworths. And, you know, the story follows them every 7 years from right. age 7, 14, 21, et cetera. You know, what they thought of themselves, they didn't always succeed, but they had their track set for them at age 7. It's pretty interesting.
Ben, thanks a lot. And Joshua, this is one of your data points, this documentary that followed people, as Ben said, age 7, 14, 21, 28. What did you take away from that on this question of how we change or stay the same?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, yeah, it's an incredible documentary series. I can't recommend it enough. And it's absolutely fantastic. One of the things that... you know, it's a really interesting thing because it's a project that's a lifetime's worth of work for a team of filmmakers. And when it started, when they made the first one, I think they had, my understanding is they had a pretty clear idea of sort of what they were aiming to show, which was how much our economic circumstances when we're young shape the course of our lives. And sure enough, I think they did find exactly what you're describing, Ben, that over the course of life, you know, where you started turns out to shape a lot of where you end up. And, you know, especially these early things about careers, about parents, but, you know, to some degree about nepotism in some cases, they kind of shape things. But then what I think strikes me when I watch that series too, is how there are certain aspects of people's lives that you never could have anticipated. Like, you know, one guy moves to Australia. Like, you know, he wasn't expecting to do that, but that's what happens. Someone else gets really involved in fostering kids. That's like a big surprise, or I'm sorry, but in helping orphan kids. Mm-hmm. You know, someone else becomes a nuclear physicist. That's like a big surprise. So one of the things that's interesting about that series is, you know, in a way, the question of whether you change through life, it kind of encourages you to think in generalities about yourself. To say, well, I've always been outgoing. I was outgoing when I was small and I'm outgoing now. I guess I'm the same person. But a lot of the things that really matter to us in our lives are really specific. I mean, they're, you know, when you think about like giving a eulogy for someone, what are the things you talk about? Well, you do say, you know, she was always kind. You know, she loved her family. But you also note that, you know, she was a huge Eagles fan or, you know, that her favorite band was, you know, the Grateful Dead or whatever, it matters. All that specific stuff matters. And there's a way where, you know, those developments in your life that you can say, you know, well, it was a certain age when I discovered something I loved forever. Like, like watercolor painting, made a big difference in my life. That's a big part of who I am. It's unexpected, and it's a big change, and it's possible to sort of discount it in this conversation. But also, maybe those things really define who we are, and they can be really consistent and really changeable too.
Ben, thanks for that call. Fun fact, one of those 7-Up kids grew up to be an engineering professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I interviewed him on the show a few years back. Now, Joshua, we just have a minute left. Why is it worth contemplating these questions?
Well, I think the simple truth is, you know, as you said, there's no right answer here. And there might not even be a permanent answer for each one of us. This might be something that we're constantly changing our minds about. And that's just because we're always looking back on our lives. We're always trying to understand who we are and where we're going. And, you know, we can one day think or emphasize in our thoughts our own consistency, and the next day emphasize our own changeability. And I think it's worth thinking about this stuff in part because sometimes you just have a way of thinking about your identity. And just by even having this conversation, you can start to see that there are other ways to think about it. That maybe, you know, you've always told yourself that you've always been the same, but you might just say, what would my life look like if I thought about it from the other perspective and looked for ways in which I've changed, and vice versa. You know, I think the more imaginative and creative you can be in thinking about your story, you know, the more opportunities for meaning you can find in your own life.
Joshua, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That was Joshua Rothman, ideas editor at The New Yorker. I talked to him last month about his piece titled, Are You the Same Person You Used to Be? Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the federal budget is inching closer to the debt ceiling, and Speaker McCarthy is laying out Republican plans as the clock keeps ticking. We'll find out what could be on the table. Plus, a look at how our brains handle language with the author of the book, The Power of Language. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, technology is changing the way we give tips in the service industry. We'll explore when and how and why we tip and what makes for good tipping etiquette. I'm Rob Barrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a proposed law in Wisconsin would limit social media access for kids. We'll hear from the state representative who's drafting that bill and from an expert in early childhood development. First, when you pay for a meal at a sit-down restaurant, we all know that a tip is generally recommended on top of the cost of the food. A lot of people will add like 20% plus or minus. What do you do when you pick up a to-go order at that same restaurant? At the register, they might have one of those touchscreens that asks you to choose a tip percentage and whether or not you want a receipt. Are you supposed to leave a tip if you're just picking up food and leaving? How about when you're grabbing a coffee or an ice cream cone or an Uber ride? The world of tipping has changed, and in the moment, it's easy to be confused about what to do. Call in now. We want to hear what you think or what you wonder about at 800-642-1234. How do you decide how much you're going to tip? How do you make the decision of whether to tip in any given circumstance? Have you encountered these touchscreen things that say, hey, here's a few different percentages you can choose? Do you like those or not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Andrew Morio is an associate professor of hospitality management and director of research at Florida International University's Chaplin School of Hospitality and Tourism Management. He previously taught at the Culinary Institute of America and worked for over 20 years in the food service industry. Andrew, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, now, I'm one of those people, I get confused in some situations, but you, with your background in academia and the restaurant industry, you're never confused, right, in those tipping moments?
I wish that was the case. You know, COVID and these electronic devices have certainly changed the pressure to tip.
Let's talk about, you know, the old days of tipping. We kind of all had a general idea that we were supposed to tip at a restaurant. How much did that factor into, you know, how much money somebody makes working in a restaurant? How big a part of their salary was that?
Right. Well, so back in the day, as well as now, it actually very much depends on state to state. In some states, there is the tipped minimum wage, which is often around $2 an hour. So say, for instance, when I was a server in Delaware during my master's degree, I was making $2 an hour was the wage. And so pretty much that just went to pay my taxes. Most of my paychecks were nothing. And everything that I relied on was my tips. So this becomes a huge factor for a lot of service employees in the food and beverage industry.
Now, let's talk about some of these modern concerns. First of all, you mentioned the COVID era. People, I among them, started getting takeout from restaurants more than going to the restaurant itself. Obviously, that wasn't even an option at some point. How does that change the etiquette when we're doing takeout as opposed to sit down?
Yeah, you know, I think there was a little bit of precedent for takeout. I've actually also worked as a pizza delivery driver, and there was a tradition in that field as well as to tip your drivers. So I think there is definitely some precedent for delivery. And then for takeout, for me personally, and I think for a lot of people, we recognize that during COVID, these employees were struggling and they were considered mandatory or essential workers. And so I think many of us tipped them even on takeouts and maybe tipped more than we would have during the pandemic because we knew that they were struggling and they were having some extra trouble. As we move out of the pandemic and into back to our new normal, I think a lot of those practices have shifted away from so much tipping on the takeout and back to more the dine-in time when you tip.
And I also mentioned this fairly new phenomenon. You pay with a credit card at the counter. It asks you in many places for your tip percentage, no tip, 8, 12, whatever it is. And of course, the employee who is or is not being tipped is standing right there. How does that change the way we handle our gratuities?
Yeah. You know, I've known a couple companies that produce those devices. And part of their marketing is to tell employers that they will increase the amounts of tips that their employees receive. And so there may be, but again, I haven't seen any academic research on that. Mm-hmm. So I say that with that caveat, but I think having the person in front of you that you're supposed to be tipping and it already on the device in front of you, so you have to actively say, no, I don't want to, I think does add some added pressure to the consumer to do some sort of tip, to provide something.
One thing I've seen at a few places in recent years, including the nearest coffee shop to where I'm standing right now, is they put up signs saying, hey, we don't want tips anymore. We're going to bump up the prices a little bit. We're bumping up our wages a little bit. And then we're taking tips off the table. Is this rare or are you seeing this as a trend?
You know, this is not a new concept. I don't know if you're familiar with Danny Meyer out of New York City.
Is he the Shake Shack guy?
Yeah, he is the Shake Shack guy, but before that, that was his casual and QSR establishment, but he has many fine dining establishments like Union Square Cafe. And he tried to do this model in his restaurants where they increased prices and took away tips and told their customers they didn't have to tip. And even with someone as progressive as him, in the end, it didn't really work out so well. And I believe they did have to reverse their policies. So while this isn't a new concept, at restaurants, it doesn't seem to be taking hold. I think at a coffee shop, it could, because the price increase you're going to see isn't nearly as much as you would in a restaurant. At a coffee shop, you know, those employees, I think by and large, are not considered tipped employees. So they're at least making the full minimum wage and not the tipped minimum wage. And yes, I'm sure they do rely on some of those tips for their income. But in the end, they are making a bit of a better wage than what we would consider a tipped employee. I would applaud those establishments that are doing that. This is just my own personal bent. But, you know, the tipping culture can cause some problems between consumers and service providers.
We are talking about tipping and gratuities in the modern era with Andrew Morio, Associate Professor of Hospitality Management at Florida International University. He's got background in the restaurant industry as well. Let's go to your calls at 800-642-1234. Nick is with us in Green Bay. Nick, hello.
Hi, I've got no problem tipping at all, but what really irritates me or offends me, I don't know how you'd say it, is these people that get on TikTok and entitlement, they're like, well, we don't get tipped enough. I mean, I tip, I even make my kids tip the dishwasher. That way they know that there's no job that's not worth anything. You know, every job is worth something. As long as you're getting paid, then you should get tipped. But
Nick, thanks a lot for the call. And David on Facebook, on the Ideas Network Facebook, seconds that. He says a tip is for going above and beyond the basic requirements for the job. They are not, David says, an entitlement. Andrew, there is this argument sometimes like, oh, no, no, a tip is supposed to be for something above and beyond. You're not necessarily entitled just for doing your basic job.
Right. And that comes down to the fundamental difference in opinion of what service providers are supposed to be providing. And my only issue with your Facebook commenter is in these places where they're only getting $2 an hour, then the assumption is that tip is part of their wage. It's really not extra for going above and beyond. It is what's expected, unfortunately, because they do rely on those tips for survival. So this is why I said I applaud the establishments that are trying to incorporate the tip into the actual price of the meal. This way, the service provider, the waiter, the server, is not relying on the expectation and, I guess, generosity of the consumer.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Nancy now in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I have a great deal of hostility about being expected to tip in any restaurant. I feel very much that this is a form of corporate welfare. Why should I be expected to pay part of their salary? This is the responsibility of the owner of the restaurant. If he has to mark up his food a great deal more, well, then he's going to get a different altogether class of customers, people who really can afford it and don't mind doing it. But I have great hostility about this. I'm tired of reading articles in the paper that restaurant owners have such a small percentage of gain from their endeavors. That's because food is so expensive and electricity is ever so much more expensive, et cetera, et cetera. I can feel my blood pressure going
right
up.
Nancy, thanks a lot for that call. Andrew, your thoughts on Nancy's thoughts on the economics at work here.
Right. And you know what, Nancy, I really appreciate your comments because it strikes to the heart of the matter. I think most people don't understand that in most restaurants, on average, across the country, when you go and spend $1 in a restaurant, it is only 5 to 10 cents of that dollar that goes to the bottom line. Everything else is eaten up by cost. So restaurateurs are very reticent to increase the wages they pay their employees because all they're seeing is that their little slim margins that they're taking home already are evaporating. This becomes especially true when you have supply chain issues and the cost of, like Nancy mentioned, the cost of electricity. I mean, let's not even talk about the cost of goods right now. Your cost of food is just astronomical and outrageous. So this goes to the idea that maybe the restaurateurs need to come up with a new business model. Because I do agree with Nancy that it's kind of a form of corporate welfare, but you know, we can look at this as the same thing in these large corporations that pay minimum wage and then expect their employees to go on government aid. It's something sort of similar. So the restaurateurs are stuck between a rock and a hard place. They want to keep their doors open, but they also need to make a profit. And so the balance is trying to figure out how to make that happen, especially when you have very cost-conscious consumers, and that's the market you're going for.
Thanks a lot for calling in, Nancy. We're talking to Andrew Morio, professor of hospitality management at Florida International University. We're looking at the new world of gratuities, when, where, how, and why we tip. Join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work someplace where you receive tips, or have you? What are your thoughts on this? If you own a restaurant or other commonly tipped kind of business, love to hear your perspective. And as a tipper, are there situations where you're baffled as to what you're supposed to do? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also join the conversation on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We pick up our conversation now with Andrew Morio, Associate Professor of Hospitality Management at Florida International University, longtime restaurant industry worker. He's with us today to help us sort through the modern cultural etiquette for tipping and gratuities. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Mary is with us in Milwaukee. Mary, hello.
Hi there. I'm going to toss in that I strongly agree with your speaker's last 2 points, his responses to both of the last two callers. I really hope that not very many people take their frustration out about the situation that we're stuck with, the structure that we have for tip-based work. Don't take that out on the worker. You know, you just don't want to make a social statement at someone's expense who is already not necessarily the most financially empowered person. I just feel like if you can afford to go eat at a restaurant, you can afford to tip the server until our system changes. The comment I was going to make, though, is that the hair salon I go to has switched to no tips. The people who do the hairdressing are paid an hourly wage that's a good wage, and it relates to their experience and their specialties. And I am super happy to move to that system. I would rather know that for the hour that the hairdresser is going to work with me, she is receiving something that is an appropriate compensation for her skill.
And Mary, did the initial price tag go up when they made that switch? Like, you know, X service costs a little bit more than it used to?
Not really, because I tip like a grown-up.
Mary, thanks a lot for the call. Andrew, what do you think of that hair salon example?
I think it's a great example. You know, I think people are very afraid that if we roll tips into the price of the meal, that they're going to receive less than stellar service. And of course, this is a possibility. But I think what you're going to find is that as employees feel more secure, more financially secure, more taken care of by their employer, that care that they feel will translate into the care they provide to their customer. And so, yes, while you're going to have bad actors, you're going to have bad eggs here and there, those will naturally weed themselves out by being let go over time. And so, you know, I think that in the end, if we could figure out a way to do away with the tipping culture, I think there's a lot of advantages to it. But I think it's a very long, hard road to even really think about that in this country.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Larry now in Janesville. Larry, hello.
Hi. I was wondering if you could talk about the law that was passed in the 1970s. For waiters and waitresses to only get $2.35 an hour.
Larry, thanks a lot. Can you talk a little bit, Andrew, about, you were talking earlier about that two-tiered system, tipped wages, minimum wage versus everybody else. Can you talk about the origins of that distinction?
You know, actually, that's beyond what I know. I don't know the origins. What I do know is that the way it works is that you have to, your tipped wages have to bring you up to the federal minimum wage. And if you do that, then everything is copacetic and you can keep that tipped minimum wage. Again, my problem with the whole thing is then you have people who have to manage all this cash. They end up having to pay taxes out of their tips, and maybe they don't know that they're supposed to do that or don't know how to do that properly. It's just it's a very flawed system that allows for people to fall through the cracks and for people to end up making far less than they need to in order to survive and to provide for their families.
Thanks for that call, Larry. Mary Lou is with us in Milwaukee. Mary Lou, hi.
Hi, nice. Thanks for taking my call. Just returned from Rochester, Minnesota, stayed in a hotel that had a nice little coffee shop, called down and ordered to pick up the food myself. Went down to pick it up, came to the cash register to pay, and the person who packed up the food handed me a bag and said, "You know, you can tip." And my response was, "Here's a tip. Don't ever ask for a tip." And I left. So that's just my take, that they think it's
their job to now tell me to tip.
Mary Lou, thanks for the call. Awkward interaction for Mary Lou there. Andrew, what do you think?
You know, it is unfortunate that there are people that will go to those lengths to get a tip. I would agree with what I think her name was Mary Lou. I would agree with her that if you have to ask for a tip, you're probably not going to get one and you may have just lost a customer. So in the service industry, it is all about providing the highest level of service that you can and hoping that you've done the job that the consumer expects so that they are interested in leaving you a tip. Now, especially in that circumstance, it's one thing to provide the option in a electronic tablet or something like that, where we talked about earlier, or even a tip jar. So everyone sees it. They know it's there. If they want to, they will. And if they don't want to, they won't. In my opinion, if I was the manager, I would be very upset with my employee that they had made that comment.
Thanks for the call. Talking to Andrew Morio from Florida International University about the new world of gratuities and tipping. Back to your calls now. Randy is with us in La Crosse. Randy, hi.
Hi. Yeah, thanks. I tip when I go to restaurants, but I always tip cash. If I'm going to a restaurant, I make sure I have some cash, because some restaurants, and usually it's bigger ones, all of that tip doesn't always go to the wait staff. And I know about this from people that I've worked with who've told me that happens. And the fact that wait or service industry in general gets the short shrift of everything, and the owners of the businesses take most of the profit, which is how it works all across our country. And Randy, I think it's despicable.
Randy, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. To Randy's first point, Andrew, and some of our commenters on Facebook have said this too. They might pay with a credit card. They'll tip in cash because of that worry about tip skimming by the restaurant.
Right. So let me tell you this. It's highly illegal. Tips are to go to tipped employees, to hourly employees. Management is not supposed to take any cut of that, period. Now, what is practice and is acceptable and is legal is tip pooling, where all the servers pool their tips and then divide it out at the end of the day. And what is also common practice is that as a server, you are to tip out other employees. So as a server, you have usually there's bussers, right? So they're responsible for water and clearing the table, but they don't get tips directly. You're supposed to tip them out a percentage. If you have a bar and a bartender, you're supposed to tip out your bartender. And then even some very progressive restaurants are now having servers tip out the kitchen staff, because I can speak from experience. A lot of times, yes, the kitchen staff will make more hourly wage than the wait staff, but in the end of the day, the wait staff will take home more overall pay because of the amount of tip they're getting, especially in a higher end restaurant. So that's part one. Part two, whether you do it in cash or credit card, when you do it on credit card, all of that tip is recorded. Now, the employees are supposed to report out all of the tips they get, whether they're cash or credit card. But if you leave it in cash, then they might not necessarily do all report all of it. And there are formulas for the minimum amount they have to report out to. So if I have cash, I leave cash and leave it up to the employees to figure out what they want to do with it. If you do put it on a card, yes, there is some chance the restaurant is going to skim. But if you have a suspicion the restaurant's skimming, you know, you might think about not dining there and take your dollars somewhere else.
Thanks for that call. And Andrew, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Happy to be here.
That's Andrew Morio, Associate Professor of Hospitality Management, Director of Research at Florida International University's Chaplin School of Hospitality and Tourism Management. He's with us today for a look at gratuities and how tipping etiquette has changed over time. If you're wondering, I don't take tips. I think I legally can't take tips. Ethically, I certainly can't. Coming up after the news, a state representative tells us about a law that would limit social media access for anyone under the age of 18. Then a childhood development expert joins us for a look at the ways that social media affects our kids. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.